Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Just a few comments and then I'll introduce my guest. I've got Jack Rasmus back again for a monthly update on the economy. Jack is an economist, a California professor. He really does terrific analysis on the economy. He's got a couple of new articles, one on how to create jobs. It's the exact opposite of what the Obama administration has been doing for the past couple of years. And he has a second article critiquing Obama's State of the Union address. And I did the same thing. I'll make a couple of brief comments about what I wrote and then let Jack jump right in. I just want to mention that I focus on lots of topics in my writing, and needless to say, with events in the Middle East right now, I have been focusing like a laser on them. This morning I was working on still another article on what is going on. It is truly, truly dramatic, breathtaking stuff. In my long life, I have never seen anything approaching what's going on, and I think what is happening, if not in all the places where it's erupting, in one or more of them, this seems to have legs, and the people are literally willing to go out on the streets and die to get what they want because they don't want to put up with any longer of what they've been forced to put up with for decades. It really, really is extraordinary. One more comment on that as well. We'll talk about this tomorrow, by the way. My guest tomorrow will be Frank Barat. And he is very involved with the Palestine Tribunal for the Russell Tribunal for Palestine. So we want to talk about his agenda and recent activities. But we have to get into what's going on in the Middle East. And the epicenter is Egypt. Egypt is so important that while the U.S. media, the major media, has basically ignored Tunisia and ignored Algeria and ignored Yemen and ignored Jordan, where there are also disruptions and people are demanding change. It may have gotten a mention here or there, but it certainly has been largely ignored. But Egypt is so crucial, so important, and what's going on there again is because Egypt is the biggest country besides 80 million people in Egypt, you get hundreds of thousands across the country on the streets, and they're defying curfews, and they're defying the police. And thankfully, the army is pretty quiescent. A lot of people in the army who are just common, ordinary people, and their family members may be out on the streets. They have said point blank they're not going to shoot civilians. Well, let's hope they stick by that. They're guarding places that they don't want torched, because the headquarters, among other places, of the ruling party's ministry was torched. Lovely. I am not in favor of firebugs, but I would say that was a lovely operation. If they can bring down a few more of these ugly ministries, that would be very lovely as well. Most lovely would be bringing down a repressive regime. Anyway, we'll talk about that tomorrow. We want to get into the economy now. I critiqued Obama. I have been on Obama's case since 2008, justifiably, because I did what few others bothered to do. I went back and I checked his voting record in the Senate. Well, if you struck out the name Barack Obama and just looked at the way he voted, he looked like a Republican. I mean, he basically backed Republican policies, pro-business all the way. He wasn't around when the Patriot Act passed, but he honest to goodness looked like a Republican. And I just went on and on, one vote after another, and it was no surprise to me what we were going to get. But it was no surprise anyway, because nobody gets the top job unless they will support the entrenched power of the country, which number one is pro-business, and number two is pro-war for pro-business, and number three is all the rest supporting wealth and power. So nobody gets that job You can call them whatever you want. You can call them an electronic image. It might as well be an electronic image as a live, breathing human being, because the entrenched power system runs the country, and it doesn't matter who the people, who the names are. The policies stay the same. Republicans, Democrats, two wings of the same party. So I have been, oh my goodness, I just can't imagine how much I've written about Obama in the last 2 years or so. Anyway, I blasted his State of the Union address last year. I blasted it again this year. And just a couple of comments, because I want to let Jack take over and discuss his two articles. I said, rightfully, his agenda embraces power and elitism over popular needs, austerity, and even harder times ahead for suffering millions, including the middle class targeted for destruction. I, honest to goodness, have no doubt of that. He embraces the worst of predatory capitalism, including freeing business from regulatory restraints, generous tax cuts for corporations and rich people who already have too much, rewarding Wall Street and other corporate favorites at the expense of Main Street, cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, other social benefits, and I honest to goodness have no doubt that they want these programs ended, but they'll be very clever about it. And they're sacrificing good, high-paying jobs for cheap, low-benefit, no-benefit, low-paying ones. So what have we got? We've got unemployment, homelessness, hunger, despair, little government aid. He's also against unions. He's also against public education. He also is for oil giants and other corporate predators freely polluting. He's also pro-war. If we don't have enough of them, he'll start another one. I mean, this just goes on and on. I am wondering why people in this country aren't getting as mad as people are in Egypt. What in hell are they waiting for? Do they expect this guy to actually turn a leaf and do something better in his second 2 years? He'll be worse in his second 2 years, not better. Anyway, Jack, I had to get all that off my chest, and I'll continue tomorrow. Welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure. Well, you really set us off with a run here.
Well, no, you are not exactly an Obama fan, so I'll let you discuss what should be done and what he's not doing.
If you were back at the very beginning, one of the first to really see what was going on with Obama, then I was a close second behind you, because I wrote an article that was published in Z Magazine in November 2008, just as he got elected, in which I predicted, watching his election year positions, I predicted that Obama's economic program would result eventually in an austerity program. And that, of course, as we know, is exactly what we're facing now in the next couple months, an austerity program. Now, that austerity program came not right away. It came 2 years later, because first thing they had to do was bail out the banks and big business and so forth. But as soon as they did that, now they are imposing the austerity program. Just a comment before we talk about his State of the Union address and our mutual analysis of it. And I also want to talk about the numbers here about GDP that just came out. But before that, a comment to follow up to you on Egypt. What you see in Egypt, of course, is a long festering problem finally erupting. But what precipitated this was rising food prices. Now, you got to understand, well, why are food prices rising in Egypt? Well, they're rising everywhere. They're rising here in the U.S. as well. Every working middle-class household going to the grocery store knows that. So why are these prices for food rising so fast all of a sudden? Well, not all of a sudden, but in the last several months. It's because of commodity speculation going on. And that's exactly what I talked about in my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, is that what we got now is a global capitalist money parade. Just investors, big-time investors, who are full of profits and funds and liquid capital, we might say. And they have their new institutions called shadow banks all over the world that are unregulated. And what these super-rich capitalists do is they are interested in jumping into these markets and driving the price up, and making huge profits by price increases and jumping out again. And then they go and create another bubble here, another bubble there. You know, you may have heard about currency wars and what's going on in European peripheral countries and in Brazil and so forth as well. Those are the same guys driving up prices for food and energy commodities, are also speculating in currencies and so forth. There's this group that has $10 trillion maybe, and they're moving it around the world, because you can now, because it's a global financial system. And they're driving these bubbles here and there and then going on to the next one and so forth. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now with commodity prices. You know, grains and foodstuffs and also metals, gold, oil, back up to $100 a barrel almost and so forth. This is where the money has gone. And this precipitates these bubbles and these crises. And, of course, when, you know, you're in North Africa and places like that, people living closer to the margin, you raise food 20%, 30%, 50%, and the people starve. And that's not the only cause of what's going on there. I mean, you know, chronic, huge unemployment for years for all kinds of people and all other kinds of social problems. And but this is what precipitated and erupted it. And it's touching us here. It's the same development, and we're going to pay more and more for food and energy over the next 6 months to a year, which means our real incomes are going to decline even more, and that's one of several factors which we can talk about that I think have a harbinger of serious problems for this recovery, notwithstanding all this talk about, oh, GDP is back to 3%. Well, whoopee. You know, you look at every recession we've had in the post-war period, and a year later, after the end of recession, we were growing by 7, 8, 9% GDP. So we're growing 3%. Big deal. You know, it's the weakest, most lopsided recovery in our history here since the Second World War. And that should be kept in mind here when we're talking about all this hype about recovery. Looking at the GDP numbers, let's dissect the GDP numbers a little bit. You know, GDP is composed of, you know, this gross domestic product, a measure of how the economy is doing. It's composed of four main elements. You know, it's got consumption, which is 70% of it. It's got business investment. It's got government spending. And it's got something what's called net exports. In other words, the difference between how much we sell to the rest of the world and how much we buy from the rest of the world. Now, if you look at those four elements, government spending is just about a net nothing. Well, how could that be? We just had this big stimulus, right? Well, because government spending includes state and local spending, not just federal government spending. And to the extent that the federal spending has risen over the last year, state and local spending has declined. So we get very little net government stimulus, which is also amazing. This is the worst recession we've had, and government spending has not risen as a way of really trying to you know, offset the decline. You know, it's an amazing development, really, that's going on.
Really, Jack, I call it Obama's anti-New Deal agenda.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay, so that's government. Government, you know, usually contributes about 20% to GDP, and it's been a net 20.3 throughout the last 2 years. There's no increase. Consumption, 70%. Okay, of GDP. Yeah, we got a little bit of a consumption boost going on, but you know what? If you look at how it's composed, it's the top 10% households that are doing most of it. In other words, the stock market boom that just occurred has enriched these people, and they're doing most of the consumption. If you look at the bottom 80% households, their consumption has not increased. And, you know, we got about 150 million households in this country. About 90, 92 million are the bottom 80. They're not consuming anymore because they don't have the money. That's one of the big problems. But and they don't invest in stocks. It's the top 10% that invest in the stock market, and we know we had a stock market boom here, and those folks are spending. Okay, but that is not even the major contribution to this recent growth here. If you look at business investment, another 15% of the economy. Now, two parts to business investment. One is, well, you think business investment is business goes out and spends and, you know, buys factories and builds factories, equipment, and so on and so forth. Yeah, well, that's part of business spending. But the other part is inventories. In other words, stocking up on their goods for future sales of those goods. Now, there's a quirky thing about GDP that people should know, and that is inventories, okay, the stocking up on goods for future sale. The way GDP is calculated, if inventories simply drop less fast than they did the previous quarter, you register an increase in GDP. In other words, let's say inventories dropped $138 billion one quarter, which is a number that happened. And then the next quarter, they declined only $50 billion, which actually happened. Instead of saying, well, we have a $188 billion decline in GDP, we would say we have a $78 billion increase in GDP. It's a quirkiness of how they calculate GDP. It makes it look like the economy is growing when it actually is declining not as fast, you see.
Jack, dare we say they are rigging the game?
No, it's just one of the ways they calculate GDP, so it doesn't look as bad as it actually is, so the politicians don't catch the heat. Now, the really quirky thing, not that one, the second quirky element in GDP is even more amazing, and that is the difference between exports and import sales. Exports is obviously what we build in this country and we sell to some other country. Imports is what other countries build and they sell to us. And we know we're buying a lot of cheap stuff from China because people can't afford not to, right? Because their income has not risen for 30 years in most cases. Well, this is another one of these accounting gimmicks. For example, if imports fall faster than exports, that's registered as an increase in GDP. And imports have collapsed here in recent quarters. People can't afford to buy things, so imports are collapsing. And because imports are falling faster than GDP, I mean faster than exports, that's considered an increase. Now, you look at the last quarter, it's hitting the newspapers now, the last quarter of GDP growth. It says, 3.2% growth in the fourth quarter of last year. Well, you know, that's an average growth. It's not great. It's not typical, but it's not negative. Now, look at it, and what you find is 80% of that 3.2% is because of this gimmick in imports falling. And why do imports fall? Because people can't afford, the bottom 80% can't afford to buy goods. And imports are rising because the dollar is falling. Okay, we won't get into that, but that's a policy to make the dollar fall. All the focus here of this growth in the last year, at first it was inventories, now it's exports. The whole policy of Obama is to focus on exports, and that's what he was talking about in his State of the Union address. But what that represents is the U.S. is exporting its recession to other countries. That's what's happening because it controls the dollar, and it's forcing the dollar to go down relative to the euro and other currencies in Japan and China, right? That's what the Chinese were over here for. We're forcing them to raise their currency. We're going to lower our currency. All that makes U.S. exports more competitive in the world, and it makes imports more expensive, hence the drop in U.S. households buying imports, hence the growth in GDP. This is not real sustained growth going on. This is not the other 90% of U.S. households buying goods. This is not business really investing in the U.S. If you look at business spending, not inventories, but for equipment and so forth, it's only one-third recovered of its loss. Business is sitting on $2 trillion, non-bank businesses, $2 trillion of cash, and they aren't spending it. Why aren't they spending it? Well, I'll tell you why. They're waiting for the Bush tax cuts to be passed, which they just were. Now they're going to spend it, but not on investment, not on creating jobs in the U.S. They're going to spend it by buying back their stock and paying out dividends to their investors. Stock buyback drives up the price of the stock. Their big investors sell the stock and make a killing. And now with the Bush tax cuts on capital gains, they make even a bigger killing. And the dividends tax cuts, they make even a bigger killing. This is exactly what the corporations did between 2002 and 2006 when they started recovering from the 2001 recession. They spent $2.6 trillion in stock buyback and dividend payments. This is what's about to happen now, and that's why they extended the Bush tax cuts, to enable this to happen again, to enable this $2 trillion again to be distributed to their stock owners. That's the game going on right now. And, of course, those who own the stock and get the dividends get even more filthy rich so they can go speculate in global commodities and drive up the price of food and make people starve in Egypt so they can't stand it anymore.
You know, Jack,
that's the connection.
This is part of at least a three-decade process of wealth transference from working Americans to America's rich, America's aristocracy. So, I mean, this has been going on since the Reagan years, and it really is a very ugly thing where incomes for ordinary working people, aside from recessions where they can take a hit with higher unemployment, and we really have an unemployment problem now, but they've basically been stagnant for the last few decades. There were some growth years in the 90s, while the rich are doing just fine, thank you very much. And
no,
in the recession,
they're doing
very well.
They're doing better every regime. You say, yes, you're absolutely right. This starts with, it starts in the late 70s with Carter, the ideas that enable this huge shift in income to the wealthy sectors and corporations, wealthy investors and corporations, at the same time holding down the income gains of the 90 million households. It results in a huge tax shift. You know, the wealthiest 1% households, according to some academic studies, earned or accrued about 8% of total national income in 1979. Today, it's 24%.
Mm-hmm.
Just about the increase at level in 1929 for these top 1% households. We're right back where we were, right before the in terms of income distribution, before the Great Depression of the 1930s, okay? And these folks make sure that they recover and they get the lion's share of the support, the subsidies from the state, from the federal government, and the rest of us have to sort of wait if we can and do without. And that's exactly what we have. You know, this is not only the weakest recovery for the rest of us, this is the most lopsided recovery we've ever had. Corporate profits back where they were just 2 years ago. Stock buybacks and dividends going on. Bankers' bonuses back where they are. Just yesterday it was reported that the hedge fund, top hedge fund, John Paulson's hedge fund, which is a private bank, one person made $5 billion. One guy, $5 billion just in the last year. And also, people should note that that fellow, Paulson, only will pay 15% tax on that $5 billion, 15% tax rate. And his good corporate lawyers will, you know, certainly knock that down to less than 10. So a guy makes $5 billion, pays less than 10%. You know, your listeners should ask, what's their tax rate? How much did they make last year? 50, 60, 70, 1,000? They probably paid about a 20% or more tax rate on that, not counting state and local taxes. This fellow pays 15%. So that, you know, the stock, the tax system explains to a great extent why you have such a lopsided situation in terms of income. Now, that super income gain by these wealthy investors has to go somewhere. You know, where's it going? It's going to China. It's going to Asia, emerging markets, causing instability there. In fact, countries like Asia, China, and Indonesia and Brazil are trying to put capital controls, in other words, prevent all this this liquid money flowing into their countries and causing superinflation, which it's doing in China. Watch China. China's pretty unstable financially. You know, they got a real property bubble going on, another bubble caused by these folks pumping money in. Brazil, you know, they have a currency bubble going on. These super rich have so much money, so much liquid money globally now. I call them the global money parade. It's got to go somewhere. So it goes where they can make the most profits. And that is in speculative ventures like commodity speculation, food speculation, currency speculation, gold speculation, property speculation. And this money sloshes around the globe back and forth, creating these bubbles, keeping the system increasingly unstable. And that's the future. More instability.
Boy, it is really.
At the same time, the real problems exist. In the U.S., despite this recovery and the rich getting super rich again, we've had 17% unemployment still. 17% when properly calculated. That's like 22, 25 million people. Hasn't budged in 2 years. Despite the deficit spending, despite all that's happened, despite the Federal Reserve pumping $9 trillion, you know, that's the real bailout story, not TARP, you know, not Congress spending $700 billion. The real bailout story is the Federal Reserve spending $9 trillion to bail out the banks, a trillion of which went to bail out foreign banks. What are we doing bailing out foreign banks, spending $1 trillion, right? And we dribble out job creation spending, you know, with a thimble. And we won't bail out the states. That's another big, the third big crisis coming. States, fiscal crisis of the states, you know. Ben Bernanke just said, no, we're not going to bail out the states. Well, gee, Ben, you just spent $1 trillion bailing out foreign banks. Why won't you bail out the states? Hmm? No, because they want to let public employees pay that bill. They want the states to continue to be fiscally in stress so that they turn around and destroy pensions and health care benefits for public workers. They want to make them pay, who didn't cause the problem, instead of bailing them out. Right? Why, if we have $1 trillion to spend on foreign banks, we won't spend some percentage of that, you know, maybe $100 billion, one-tenth, to bail out our own cities and states. Now, that's amazing. Or even less than that, to bail out 10 million people who will face foreclosure.
Jack, could I put that in perspective very briefly? By the way, the number I saw was the Fed giving the banks the number that I believe we know about. I mean, who knows what the real number is, because the Fed doesn't disclose anything unless you grab them by the throat and start squeezing. The number I saw was $12.3 trillion. But the perspective I wanted to mention was the supposed combined deficit this year, this fiscal year for the states, is around $140 billion. I mean, that's a minuscule fraction of the money given to the banks. And we say we don't have, we can give, you know, so many trillions, whether it's 9, 12, whatever it is, to the banks, and we can't give $140 billion to the states?
Well, actually, the $9 trillion is a public number. The Fed was forced to give a one-time audit report and last summer. And in that report, it admitted to $9 trillion, and $1 trillion went to foreign banks. It admitted that, okay? Now, it's probably more than that, but that's what it admitted to. You know, and we can't spend on jobs, and we can't help homeowners, and we can't bail out the states. Now, that's the real crisis.
That's the real crisis.
The unemployment, Jack. The foreclosures in the states.
Oh, indeed. Jack, we have to take a break. But it sends a very clear message to me. We're not helping the states and people because we want to hurt them. We don't want to help them. But on that pregnant thought, let's take a brief break, and we'll come right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down or you're just curious, be sure to listen in Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. That's K-A-R-A-L-E-E @GaryKnoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world, every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
On with Jack Rasmus, with Jack's usual brilliant analysis of the economy. And I must say, Jack, in the back of my mind, always as I watch events daily, not just the economy, but so much more. But just on the economy, just on that alone, I scratch my head and I reflect back to when I was young, like so many young people today, on the one hand wondering, what on earth kind of future do they have to look forward to? And I remember the future that I thought I had to look forward to. It turned out to be very accurate when I finished school in the winter of 1960. And that period was not the strongest economic time. I literally had about a one-day pause between the time I picked up my diploma in a very, shall we say, ad hoc graduation ceremony, which is what happens when you graduate mid-year. They don't make a big deal out of it. No big major commencement, no matter what school you go to. It certainly wasn't a big deal for me, although I had to have a cap and gown. I had no idea why, but I did. We simply went into an office building and gathered in an auditorium, and those of us who graduated, there were a fair number, we all were congratulated and handshaking and the rest of it. But anyway, there was about a 24-hour pause, and I began my first job.
Well, I mean, just imagine the kids getting out of school today. I had a future to look forward to. The kids today, I honest to goodness don't know what they have to look forward to, the great majority of them.
No, not much, you know. I mean, in the 1960s, it was a boom period.
Well, not the year 1960 itself, Jack.
By the way, the difference between then and now, one of the many, is that the tax cuts that were granted to get us out of the 1960 recession, business tax cuts under Kennedy, if you were a business, you did not get to claim the tax cut until you created the job. Now we give them tax cuts and all kinds of business tax cuts, and they don't have to prove that they created jobs, even though it's called an investment business tax cut.
Can I add one thing?
Yeah.
When I went to work, Eisenhower was still president.
Pardon me? Oh, Eisenhower created the 58 recession and then 60s recession because he cut back government spending because the the big multinational corporations said we got to balance the budget. Sound familiar? Cut back spending, and we got recessions in the two periods, 57, 58, and 60, 61. Now, Kennedy stimulated the economy with a business tax cut, but you had to prove you created jobs. So, in other words, business not only got the benefit, but workers got the benefit, too, from that. Now you can get the tax cut if you go create jobs in China. You know, that's the difference we got going on now. And, of course, that's the Reagan policies. Things have not changed from Reagan, even though we have Clinton in between and we got Obama now. It's the same policies. Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Obama, it's the same set of policies, all of which ultimately are designed to increase the relative income of wealthy investors and corporations at the expense of the rest. It's gone on 30 years, and now people just don't have the money to spend, and the bottom 90% households can't spend. They can't get the economy going because they don't have the income. They don't have the jobs. You see, jobs, creating jobs for the 25 million is the first and quickest way to boost that income. But Obama's not interested in creating those jobs. His whole strategy is not to create jobs. Now, that may sound radical to people, but it's not. His whole strategy when he came into office was to save the banks. In other words, get the banks going again, the big 19 banks, not the 8,000 small banks, which are falling by the wayside like flies still, the big banks, and to get the big corporations back on their feet and to boost profits. And the whole strategy was predicated on the assumption that if they did this, if they bailed out the banks and the big corporations, then those folks would eventually start lending to small, medium businesses and start spending to create jobs. Well, neither of those two assumptions happened. Banks did not start lending to small businesses, where most of the jobs are created, or lending on very onerous terms so they couldn't really borrow. As I said earlier at the beginning, large, medium, large businesses, multinational corporations, sitting on $2 trillion in cash, and they're not spending it, at least not here, you see. So that was the big failure, the big strategic error, to rely on business and the markets, as we say, to really get the economy going, not to bail out, not to create jobs. You know, what he did was spend some money on the unemployed and spend some money on subsidizing state and local government for a year. But this was just to buy time, and the whole strategy was assuming that if you buy time for a year, then the private sector, the markets would kick in and would generate the recovery. Well, reliance on the markets got us into this problem in the first place, the crisis. And now we're going to rely on those markets, those same guys, the banks, who precipitated the whole problem to get us out of it. You know, what we need is a direct government job spending program of massive dimensions. It doesn't even need to be as great as the $9 trillion to bail out the banks. And you don't even have to spend to directly create jobs, government, and raise the budget. In my article in Z Magazine coming out next week, How to Create 15 Million Jobs, what I do is say, how could the government directly create jobs? Well, to do so, you got to go back to the 1930s. And you got to say, okay, what were the job creation programs then? How could we recreate them in a 21st century form today to create 15 million jobs? And where would you get the money to do that without raising the deficit? Well, I lay out exactly how you could do that. I mean, it's quite doable. Where you get the money? Well, I talk about six programs, six changes. Well, actually, five changes in restructuring the tax system, so that the government can raise revenues to create 15 million jobs. Taxing the U.S. multinational corporations, their offshore profits, for one. A wealthy investor's tax haven repatriation tax. You know, there's somewhere between $6 and $11 trillion held in offshore tax havens today, globally. And about 40% of that is probably U.S., so it is about $4 trillion wealthy investors and corporations have socked away in 27 different countries, little countries, Cayman Islands, Vanuatu, you know, Seychelles Islands, and so forth. In Europe, they stuff it in Liechtenstein, Isle of Man, Cyprus, and places like that. All of them stuff it in, you know, Swiss banks. There's about $250 billion in 1980s. It's grown to about $6 to $11 trillion today. Well, require those investors to bring that money back to the U.S. That's all. I'm not saying take it from them. Just put it back into the U.S. That would bail out the banks, of course, and give them so much cash they'd have to start lending. And, of course, those wealthy investors would have to pay taxes now, which is the reason why they're putting it offshore. But bringing that money back, you could raise $500 billion. The new tax revenue, forcing the multinational corporations to bring their money back, $350 billion. Put a 10% corporate surtax charge on the $2 trillion that they are hoarding now and refusing to spend. If they won't spend it on jobs, then the government should take it and spend it on jobs. Require all wealthy individuals making more than the 106,000 ceiling on the payroll tax to pay payroll tax on all their capital incomes. That would raise another 170 million. Impose a financial transaction tax on stock trades, bond trades, and derivative trades. Another 150 billion. And we're talking like 10 cents on the dollar or 10 cents on a trade or something like a stock trade, a dollar. You know, you pay Charles Schwab $7.95 to make a stock trade. Okay, so you put a tax of $1 on that financial transactions tax. These five different tax reforms would raise $1.5 trillion. Now, if you have a job costing about $50,000 a year, let's say $40,000 in salary, another $10,000 in benefits per year, and you raise $1.5 trillion, you know, how many jobs could you create? Well, quite a few. We would have to create certain institutions, new job-creating institutions, in order to spend that additional tax income that, once again, would not bust the budget, would not cause a penny increase in the budget deficit. So what would these look like? Well, I outlined seven programs. One called an Alternative Energy Public Investment Corp, which would spend $250 billion of that $1.5 trillion. In other words, this would be a government department that would simply invest directly in alternative energy itself, not pump money into private corporations, but, in other words, to create alternative energy and alternative energy jobs directly itself. You know, a civilian a reconstruction corporation. You know, during the 1930s, we had the Civilian Conservation Corps, where young folks were, a couple million young folks were sent into the rural areas to clean up, the forest, and to build rural roads, and so on and so forth. Well, we need to have the same thing to rebuild our cities, a civilian reconstruction corporation in our urban areas. A third would be a community health services corporation, once again a government corporation, that would build along with the CRC that would build the local clinics, health clinics, and staff these health clinics. You know, we've got these 50 million people without insurance right now. Well, rather than subsidizing the health insurance companies, in other words, taking taxpayer money under the health bill to pay these insurance companies, why shouldn't the government simply expand its public hospital system and create these clinics where people without insurance could go themselves? Okay? You know, you wouldn't even have to build buildings. You could take over a lot of city buildings that are empty and so forth and create these health clinics and create jobs in the health clinics. And you can get professionals who are doctors and nurses already and say, okay, come work in these clinics, and we'll consider it pro bono work. In other words, you can, instead of us paying you directly, you can take it off your taxes. You know, I think you'd find a lot of doctors and nurses who would probably work in these clinics for an extra tax deduction. Fourth, a 21st century Public Works Progress Administration, just as we did in the 1930s. You know, we had a workforce of about 40 million in the 1930s, a fourth of which were unemployed at the time. And the Works Progress Administration, you know, which built and employed people of all kind of occupations, created 8 million jobs. In other words, today that would be like the government creating 30 million jobs if we had something similar to that. And there are other programs. I'm not going to go through them here, but in other words, I'm being specific as to where you get the money without increasing the budget deficit, and exactly what kind of government agencies you would create and how many jobs could they create and how would this work. You see, there are so many people today, Stephen, that are criticizing the crisis, analyzing the crisis, and that's all fine. It's all good. But we're sort of past that now. We kind of know what happened. What we got to do and what the debate and discussion should be is what the hell are you going to do about it?
Oh, indeed.
If private business won't create jobs, if the government won't do anything about foreclosures, if they're leaving the states and cities, you know, to their own collapse and bankruptcy, then somebody's got to propose something.
Jack,
the government has to do something, and they're not.
Jack, something is rotten in Denmark. And the other question is not only the one that you posed, but why is the government doing the exact opposite of what needs to be done? What in hell are they doing? Why are they harming people instead of helping them?
Because they don't want to pay for it. In other words, the wealthy corporations and investors don't want the government to do these things. They want the government to stay out of direct job creation, stay out of public investment, because even though they're not doing anything in those areas now, they want to reserve it for themselves if they should want to do it later.
Well, you know what they want. I mean, they want a large, huge reserve army of labor so they can get lots of it cheap, you know, buy everything 10 cents on the dollar or something like that. You know, wreck corporations and then buy cheap assets and then build them back up again and have a huge reserve army of labor. And they love undocumented immigrants because you get all those people. You can practically get them at slave wages and they can't complain because you'll turn them in and they'll be sent back home again. So, I mean, they just want cheap labor, a few or no benefits, and incrementally we're working our way toward that, where we will all be, I would guess, the majority, a sort of neo-serfdom is what Michael Hudson calls it. Neo-serfdom, and it looks like we're really heading for that.
They want you all to be super thankful that you got a part-time or temporary job with no benefits. That's what they want. Okay? And that's what's growing, you know? I mean, it's not just low-paid service jobs. There's like 30 million people or more who are part-time workers in this. In another 10 million, 40 million out of a workforce of 150 million are part-time temp workers.
Or the other choice, right? Join the military and get your head blown off.
Yeah, that's the other option. You know, if you're poor inner city urban youth, yes, that's the other option. And you're absolutely right. They want a very tame, complacent workforce, and you know, they they sort of beat up on the unions in order to ensure that, because if you don't have strong unions or any union at all, then there's no way as an individual worker that you can really express yourself, you know, without getting picked off. And, of course, they've pretty much destroyed the private sector unions. We're down to less than 7% unionization in the private sector. I mean, it's never been that low in over 100 years. And, of course, the only sector left where unions are strong is the public sector. And that's why they're going after the public sector. You know, they're going to use the fiscal crisis. Another reason why they don't want to bail out the banks is to use, I mean, bail out the cities and states, is to use the fiscal crisis to have the cities in particular, and states some, declare bankruptcy. It's phony bankruptcy, but to declare bankruptcy means that all the contracts you have now, just like a corporation, you know, if it declares bankruptcy, all its contracts that it owes people and so forth and its unions are null and void. And they want the states and cities to declare bankruptcy as a way of pretty much eliminating the unions. Or if they don't eliminate their unions, then they're going to say, okay, the contract we had with you is null and void. Let's start from scratch. And then you're going to get a contract that pays far less, no benefits, and fewer rights. You know, they want to return to the civil service wage-setting process. So they're really going after the public sector unions to bust them, just as they busted the private sector over the last 30 years. And that's a big objective behind this, why we're not going to bail out the states and cities anymore. You know? Let them go bankrupt. And, of course, part of that bankruptcy is states and cities are going to exit from the Medicaid system in huge numbers, particularly in those Republican states. So you're going to have even more people without health care than you have today. Yeah, and even Obama, in his State of the Union, if you listen to it very closely, he said one brief sentence, and that sentence was, we need to cut Medicare and Medicaid, period. Then he moved on. Okay, well, that was a signal.
Oh, he said it many months back, Jack. I mean, I've written about that several times where I believe there was one dramatic time, I believe, and I think it was at the beginning of last year. I mean, he basically, when the health care debate was going on, where they came up with this package of cutting $500 billion out of Medicare, and he didn't talk as much about Medicaid, but you really got to package the two together. $500 billion out of Medicare? I don't think it's all come out. And there's a lot of debate about it, but there's no question that they want to slash those big entitlement programs.
Yeah, and you know, the Tea Partiers aren't totally incorrect. You know, they're a kind of reactionary group in many ways, but they're mostly middle-aged and older white folks, and they really sensed that something's going to happen here with their Medicaid, Medicare benefits, and they're quite right. There's going to be some changes in that particular area that's going to shift the cost, you know, onto the recipients and away from the government. You know, they can't stand the fact that you have something like Social Security and something like Medicare in this country. They, the wealthy folks in corporations and particularly wealthy investors, you know. The AFL-CIO, by the way, just sent an email around the last couple of days that there's this big gathering of these very right-wing, reactionary, conservative corporate or capitalist investors. You know, they're not even CEOs. These are the folks that are so rich, they don't manage companies. They just manage their hundreds of millions and billions of dollars. And they've been funding the Tea Party and so forth, these right-wingers, very wealthy right-wingers. And they've been gathering. Every year they gather, you know, scores of them, and plot out how they're going to get the government to do what they want. And, you know, they've just discovered that this group exists, the AFL-CIO. And, you know, they're sort of saying they're gathering again, right? Well, these are the folks who sit way behind the scenes and really pull the strings, you know. And they fund, of course, the politicians. So you think the politicians are doing this, but they're just doing the bidding of these kinds of very wealthy groups, who, by the way, also fund them. The talk shows and the think tanks and so forth, you know. It's about time we dug down and saw, who's behind the curtain here, and who's really coming up with these proposals like, you know, don't bail out the homeowners and don't really create jobs and don't bail out the states, let them go bankrupt and all that stuff.
Oh, indeed so. Indeed so. It is a very disturbing situation, Jack, and it is shocking that, and I say it on this program quite often, that instead of government being the ally of the people, government, including under a Democrat that a lot of people had far too much faith in, government is the enemy, not our ally, because government is allied with the wealthy and powerful of the country, and in plain English, they simply don't give a damn about ordinary people. If they
well,
did,
government
they would have
per
done
se
something.
Is not the enemy. The enemy is, you know, behind the government, and they've just bought it. That's all, you know. Unlike used to be more of a compromise here, you know, different interests in society, you know, and so forth. But now, you know, ever since Reagan, they've taken it over increasingly. And this, you know, what you see in this new austerity and cooperation between Obama and the Republicans coming is that the elites within the two parties, who are financed, by the way, by the same interests I'm talking about, these elites are coming together. In other words, there is increasing consensus now that they bailed out the banks and so forth, what should be done next. And there's really no difference, you know. I mean, if you look at every candidate who's run for top office, presidency in the Democratic Party, and big senators as well, these are all from this sector of the Democratic Party called the Democratic Leadership Conference, the DLC, which they claim, oh, it doesn't exist anymore. No, it doesn't exist in the sense that it did in the 1980s because it's the dominant group, you know, within the Democratic Party. The corporations really went in and took over the Democratic Party starting in the late 1980s, okay, just as they got more active and took over the Republican Party in the last part of the 1970s. It's not that they, quote, weren't the power base in the Republican Party in the 70s. Yes, they always were, but now they really started to exercise their power and control and took it over, and that's how you got Reagan and his policies. Well, the same thing happened in the Democratic Party starting in the late 1980s. This is not the Democratic Party of Roosevelt. And this is not even the Democratic Party of Kennedy Johnson. This is a corporate-dominated Democratic Party in which the progressive popular elements are marginalized more and more and more over the years. And that's where Obama comes from, okay? You know, that's where Lieberman comes from. That's where Gore comes from. That's where Clinton comes from and so forth. It's much more cohesive kind of a elite now within the Democratic and Republican parties, and they're doing their own bidding jointly.
So true, Jack. The hour goes by so fast, and this is big stuff, obviously. When the economy is really flagging and so many people are hurting so badly, they really are hurting badly.
Watch what's happening internationally, Steve. Japan's going into recession again. China's slowing down. Brazil's slowing down. European periphery is in trouble. The periphery in Asia is heading for a double dip. Globally, the situation is not any better.
I would guess we will probably follow at some point in time. China often can be a bellwether, I believe, Jack. And, of course, they're raising interest rates, and they're putting up some barriers. Oh, we're out of time. We're already past the top of the hour. Many, many thanks. I look forward to next time, Jack.
As well.
Thank you so much.